You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So thank you so much, Christina. Thank you. Julia? That was a fantastic sort of summary of really what's at stake, and I've been following it. But I have to say I'm even more jazzed now, particularly because you have the government perspective and this idea of we do have a big global moment, but what are we going to do about it? Which really means that we all have the power in this room to seize the day. And that's exactly what I want to talk about on this panel, which is really focused on, what does it look like to seize the day, and what does it look like, particularly if you can help support at a global level and connect to agents of change at a local level. And the Echidna Scholars Program, which is funded by the wonderful and lovely Echidna Giving. And somewhere in this room, there's Kim, the CEO, and there's other team members. I don't know, Aaron or Lex, where she's sitting right, okay, behind Christina, I couldn't see you, are here with us. And they've been incredible partners from the very word go on this initiative. And I feel like most of you know the Echidna Scholars Program. It's kind of got a brand of its own. I have to say at the very beginning, I thought the name was weird, but I've gotten over it. And now I don't even think that it's a funny little animal in Australia. Like, it is the Echidna Scholars Program, and everybody knows who the Echidna Scholars are. And we're going to be speaking, and I'll introduce them in a moment, to four alumni of the program to really sort of get insight on Julia's challenge to us, which is, if we have the space at the global level, what are we going to do with it? And particularly, what are we going to do with it in terms of empowering local leaders? And before we do that, you four don't stand up. Everybody knows you. I would like all the Echidna Scholar alumni who are in the audience to just stand up and wave your hands. And maybe we can give everybody a big round of applause. So every 2 years, we have a big family reunion, and all the alumni get together. And we are so lucky to be in one of those years. And they've all traveled far and wide, and we're incredibly grateful to all of you for everything you're doing and to yet again take time out of your busy lives to come and spend some time with us. So let's get to it. Damaris, you have everyone's bios, so I'm not going to do a full intro. And we're going to get to know them little by little. As a professor at Egerton University in Kenya, and we're going to hear more about her work and what she's been up to. Madalo is running the leadership of CRECOM, I think it is the largest Malawian NGO. Did I get that right? Yeah? No.
One of them.
Okay. I've been kind of overselling CRECOM, maybe. But a very large Malawian NGO. Mayada, who is the founder of World of Letters in Jordan, and Khadam from Pakistan, who is the founder of Grace Association. And so I wanted to talk a little bit with you all first about your experience in the field of girls' education and how you came to it, how you ended up here at the Echidna Scholars Program, what you've been doing since. Mayada, maybe we should start with you. We'll skip around. So, Mayada, you had studied, I believe it was chemistry. Geology, okay. Hard science. She's a very hard science gal. You wouldn't know it to look at her. But you studied geology. You were working in a lab in the oil and gas industry. And you had an incredibly difficult experience, which was basically you were harassed constantly. You were the only woman. You were in Jordan. You were harassed constantly because you were a scientist. And they had never met a woman scientist before, your colleagues, and basically pushed out of your company. And you had a bit of a moment of like, well, wait a minute. What does this mean? I'm educated. I've had a master's degree. You know, what must it be like for other women? And I remember right before you came to Echidna Scholars Fellowship, you had been running the Education for Employment program. You were the CEO of the Jordan Education for Employment program, which is a skills to work program. And you had trained all these women, really trained them up in skills for which there were open jobs, and you had lined up employers who said, we want to hire them. And none of the women took the jobs. And so you were kind of at a crossroads. So tell us from that point, you know, what was going on in your head? Why did you seek out the Echidna Scholars Program?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think so.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'm actually a geologist, and in Jordan, I worked at Natural Resource Authority. In Jordan, there are scientists, but geology is just a male job. It's a job for males. So that's how I got harassed to leave a job for another male. And when I worked at EFE, we worked with 4,000 youth. 50% were females, and almost 40% actually declined existing jobs contracts. So when I dug deeper into back then onto what was the problem, it was basically the male members of the family that actually restricted her, restricted the type of jobs that she could take. So that's when, you know, sometimes when you do something many times in your professional life and then you just stop and say, something is going wrong. I need to do something different. Because if you do the same thing over and over and over again, the same thing, you're not going to get different result. So I had to get out of my narrow focus and go into a more global focus, a global, you know, understanding. So I realized that we had to work on mindset change. I realized that in 20 years, not much has changed, and there are some acceptable jobs and unacceptable jobs. I worked in the governorate and in the poorest areas. So then I decided maybe we should look at the education system. We should look at the curriculum. Let's see what are the messaging that are there in these curriculums that are, you know, socializing girls and boys into different places. So I applied and got accepted here. But before I left, I went to the Ministry of Education. I told them, look, I'm doing this, you know, study at Brookings Institution. It's a very big name in Jordan. I'm very excited. And then the woman tells me, like, wait, you're wasting your time. Why is that? She goes, we gender sensitized the books for a long time ago. And, you know, we worked also with the Ministry of Education. We have gender focal points in every directorate. We've done this. You're just wasting your time. So I left. I came here and I did the mapping of textbooks for 4 months back in 2014. And the messaging, yes, they had gender sensitized, but only when it came to women's role in their private sphere. So basically at home. But they did not put her out in work. So no women were allowed to work. Also, they had pulled women out of the you know, cleaning and kitchen and all that, you know, this care, home care, but they never put her out in the public sphere as well. So women disappeared from the curriculum. So when I came back, I was like, this was a big war to fight because you can't touch curriculums in our part of the world. It's very political, right? So I went, the first thing I did was really, I worked with the media. So the media were the first entry point. Social media, I went on mass media. Then I went to the Ministry of Education themselves and did workshops with them. The director was a female. And when they did their own mapping, they were like pointing at each other. You put this. No, you put this. It was kind of funny. And she was like in the end saying, you know, I can't believe that we have this kind of messaging in textbook, and I am a female director. So then they said, okay, let's do some changes. They did a band-aid, like facelift kind of changes. Let's remove a statement. But the core of the messaging were still there. So 2015, I'm there pushing the first one to start. Another movement came. It was a bigger policy level movement. And the Ministry of Education decided we want to modernize our curriculum. I had already started this small movement, right? So they started and they did a very fast job, maybe too fast. They started removing pictures of women with covered and putting uncovered. They started removing certain religious sentences. It was like it was a very randomly, fastly done, which led to riots. And there were problems and riots all over the country. And here I was trying to, you know, maneuver between what was going on. It wasn't even done very scientifically, and things went out of context. So you would open the book, see something. Oh, here it is. Look at the statement. Rather than doing a proper mapping of, you know, get a conceptual framework, you know, create a scope and sequence chart. And I don't want to go into all the details. So when the whole riots came up, people started burning books in the South. And it was like a whole kind of mess. So the government moved back and started thinking, what can we do? And realized that maybe the movement was too fast. So they created the National Center for Curriculum Development. And that's where I found my opportunity. A leader, and she was like a great leader. I went to her and told her, look, this is my study. So they meet, they had subcommittees for creating new textbooks. And I created a group where we could all work as gender specialists on these subgroups. So we're now training authors who are writing the new books. They put me as a gender specialist in one of the committees as well, which is the early childhood education. So basically now any new books that are going to come up in the future in 2018, 2019, we're going to have it hopefully gender sensitized. So 4 years, but a lot of fighting, but we reached there.
It's quite impressive. And when you talk, you know, at Brookings, we talk about research to impact. That is definitely research to impact, not only cause curriculum reform across the country, but riots, which is maybe not what you were intending to do when you wrote your initial study here with us. But I wanted to just follow up, Mayada. You know, it's been very intense. You came, I remember when you were doing your study here and you were looking, you just spent hours and hours. She had stacks of books in her office of all the curriculum, just doing the audit, looking at it, reading lots of stuff. And you were talking about, you know, what, I wonder what can really be done. Because again, curriculum was very hard to change. So who would have guessed that you would have had such a large impact? What do you think was the most useful part of your Echidna Scholars experience to help you get that impact?
Yeah, so when I started looking at the books, I mean, they had gender sensitized, and I just, at the point, I just stood there and said, what are we going to do? Because curriculum is a long-term change, right? It's going to take 10 years to change a narration. And I remember we had this discussion also with Christina. It's like, Christina, what do we do now? We reverted to social theories. I looked at belief mediation theory. And in the belief mediation theory, we looked at objective barriers, barriers to women entering the workforce, like pay equity or transportation systems or maybe, you know, daycare centers. And then there were the belief system. And in this belief mediation theory, which then I used to frame my research, we had to balance both the objective and the subjective belief system. And because I couldn't do it in the curriculum, it will take too long, I started going to women organization, organization that work on women economic empowerment. I remember very well Christina saying, look, go to already existing systems and enter into it. So I went to them, and I had so many meetings. So at the point I entered to this Jordan National Commission for Women to Secretary General, she looks at me and says, where is my blue book? I was like, which blue book? She goes, you know, where is my blue book? So I had given so many of these research books that you see in your, with you. She's like, where is my blue book? So I gave her the blue book anyway. And whenever I spoke to them, they always listened, but they never said that, you know, this is not what we're going to work on. But yeah, this is going to take too long. This is too soft. Let's do skill building. This is, how are you going to measure it? Donors were like, how are we going to see results? So I couldn't really get people on board. I got just these like-minded people, and he said, let's do something about it. So we decided maybe we should create a Joe Monomics initiative. And the nice thing about Joe Monomics is it's a tongue twister, and donors love it. So they gave us money, which is great. And
if it were only that easy at all cases.
Yeah, so it was inspired by the Monomics movement in Japan, Shinzo Abe's movement, also something we had to come up with, Christina, when we were looking at it. And so I started that with like-minded people. We went to a small community, and we said, you know, we're going to start doing bottom-up approach. Let's go there and start doing our awareness campaigns. But before that, let's go to the religious leaders. So we went to a mufti. So Mufti is a religious leader that actually gives you like the understanding of Islam and the Quran and the, you know, the Prophet saying. So I try to understand what is the role of women in Islam, and we found incredible verses, incredible content, incredible information that empowers women in Islam. One of which, that the first wife of the Prophet Muhammad was actually a businesswoman. So we used that going to these communities. We created a committee of starting with the municipality leader, the governor. We got religious leaders. We got CBOs. We got even heads of tribes. I'm sure there was intelligence also sitting there in these meetings. And we sat there and we began to, you know, discuss openly, the private sector as well. What are the challenges? We discussed it openly, used some of the narrative we got, and then we went there and we started doing our training and employment program. We worked in the committee starting from the committee itself. So women economic empowerment became a community priority. This was done in Mafraq, in the north of Jordan, close to the Syrian border. Like, there were stray bullets sometimes they would get in the area. We were successful, got 30 women in job, and 130 women followed. So the Joe Nomic Initiative became a non-profit. And there's a big non-profit, and now we're working on 500 women in 5 communities throughout Jordan.
And I'm sure we could hear all... Yeah, you can clap. Go ahead. Someone
okay,
started.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sure we could listen all day, actually, to all of you. But I'm sorry to interrupt, Mayada. I want to move on to Khadam, because Mayada is talking about... really mindset change, and that, you know, part of what she did here with us at Brookings is really think about, take the time to think strategically about how you do mindset change. And I know that's something you have had to do from the beginning of Grace Association. So Khadam started as a child activist for the children's right to education. He grew up in Gilgit Baltistan, a region I have visited in Pakistan, which is incredibly remote. Some of you may have been there. If anybody remembered reading the book Three Cups of Tea, that is where he lives. And got polio at the age of 1 as a baby. And his father, like many parents, good fathers, cares, loves their children, but thought, if you are disabled, you can't go to school. He literally started a child rights to education movement out of his backyard, because all of his siblings and all of his friends were going to school, and he didn't get to, you know, the year came and went and he never went to school. His second year passed, and he convinced all of his neighborhood friends to put him in a wheelbarrow and take him to school. And so he is an activist through and through. And one of the things he noticed was it wasn't just disabled kids like himself who had to fight against parental beliefs. It was girls that, you know, some of the girls in his community, just like him, weren't going to school with him. And so he became a real activist, founded Grace Association for Inclusive Education. All kids, particularly kids with girls who are kept out of school and kids with disabilities. And Khadam, can you tell us a little bit about your experience when you came here for the Echidna Scholars Program? What did you work on, and what was the most impactful? And then... what did you do when you went back?
Good morning, everyone. So as you mentioned, that my story starts with my own striving for my own education. So I faced all the attitude you mentioned. And then my sister, the youngest sister, she inspired me, because my parents, when I was able to go to continue my school, one day she took my book, and my parents forbidden her. That sparked in my mind, why? So she wanted to write something, but they wanted just she read the Quran. You know, so that sparked in me. And then we began the campaigning for community awareness. We went door to door. And then continuing my own education, this is worthy to mention here that after school, I tried to go to university. in Pakistan, but no university iPhone accessible. You leave the school situation in remote villages. And still there is no university physically. All advised me to continue education, higher education through distance learning. So as a protest, I didn't do that, and I returned to my work to learn by doing. So since there, and then I got this opportunity at Brookings. So before that, I didn't know myself and my work that was important for all of you. I really recognized that, empowered, and felt me confident that I was doing locally, that was recognized by you. Thank you for working as CEO, Dr. Winthrop. So after that, when I went back, I started my post-research intervention. I actually studied here how to foster inclusive education in Pakistan, though I was selected to study girls' education. But being a polio victim, a wheelchair user, I thought it's my responsibility to study inclusive education as well. So Dr. Rabika accepted that, and I did that study here. And thanks for Echidna for the post-research intervention support that enabled me to reach out 53 village communities at his schools. We identified more than 1,000 out of school children among 80,000 population in 53 schools, and 54% were girls, and 9% were children with disabilities. So what we did, we sensitized the communities about this data. We organized seminars, conferences, and we shared the data with the communities we were working for, and we collected the data from, and they had supported me. And also this opportunity, what enabled me that we are running schools, and we are running English language programs. That is called English Access Programs and English Works Programs. So we hire many people. So they have more qualifications and experience than me, but the Brookings reputation may be work, because being a person with disability, still in the society, the people do not accept a person like me easily, that he can do something. They don't believe in. But I lead, and I had more than over 100 more qualified people. So these things contributed, yeah.
And I know you have been working with the government, you've been advising the government, and it's all focused, I know, on really inclusive education in the most rural, hard-to-reach communities. And you were telling me that before you came to Brookings, the government wouldn't give you an audience. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yes, sure. During the post-research intervention, we started, we really formed four community school networks. That was my dream before coming here. But I was unable to do that after my return. So with the data and the formation of the four community school, that means 20 school in each cluster in one community school network. We call that CSN. So with that, we have a lot of boys' school in villages. We work in those remote villages where government rarely works. And still, the majority of communities have no girls' school, but they have boys' school, government school or community school. So what I did was we broke the culture or mindset of the people that a boys' school can be used only for boys. We made few sample schools inclusive, accessible for children with disabilities, and also met with the government and did advocacy to just giving permission for the school administrator, the head teacher, and local school management committee to enroll girls. So far they were not doing that. That was a mindset. So we broke the mindset. And now, in those communities, the teachers enroll I tried for a written approval, but the people work in Pakistan. No government agencies very hesitate to give a written permission, but they very friendly verbally. So I used the verbal permission and broke the culture.
Which is a great story. Yes, indeed. Madala, let's turn to you. You grew up in a sort of rural Malawian village, 8 siblings. Three sisters. You were one of four. It was very even, your parents, 4 and 4. And you saw your older sister go through initiation ceremonies, as is tradition for girls to do, and get married immediately after and drop out of school. And you have talked about what an impression that made on you, that you did not want to follow that path. And how you basically, I mean, it was pretty gutsy, I would imagine, if you're a young girl in a rural village in Malawi, defied your parents and said, nope, I'm not doing that, and I'm staying in school. And then it paved the way for the rest of your siblings. All the rest of your sisters were able to do the same thing. And from that moment, you've been very committed to trying to do that for all of the girls in Malawi. Can you tell us a little bit about your interest in really working with tribal leaders to try to, just like Kadam talked about, like just shifting a mindset to help girls stay in school, and you know what you did here at Echidna when you were an Echidna scholar?
Sure, happy to do that. I grew up in rural Malawi, and my parents divorced, and really living in poverty, as well as ascribing to our tribal values and practices. And actually, that's what saw my senior sister go into this initiation ceremony, and she ended up getting pregnant. But I think I was born naturally a very defiant child, questioning everything around me.
It gives me hope with my defiant children that they will do great things like Madalu.
I remember my mother used to have problems with me earlier on, and really asking my dad how they should deal with me, because I questioned everything. I remember one day she telling me about to do some household chores, and I think I was busy doing something else, and she said, you know, you're going to have problems when you grow up, because as a woman, as a girl, you need to grow up and be able to, you know, manage your home. And I told her, I said, you know what, I'm going to get educated and I'll have a good job and I'll have somebody to take care of my chores at home. She laughed it off. But that's really what was pushing me, that, you know, young mind to be somebody, because I didn't want to be poor. And really, I was selected to a merit-based University of Malawi early on in 1993. And luckily, there was a USAID girls' education program that started in the country, and we were deployed as interns doing action research and the theater for development performance. So I was an actor, an action researcher. So we moved in many parts of Malawi, tribal villages, living in the villages and learning the lives of girls in different tribal villages. And really, you know, looking the power that is inside these girls. And I saw myself in many of those girls. During performances, we could see grandmothers crying, their eyes, you know, moist after maybe they had married off their granddaughter, because that's what they believed was the best for their children. You could see, you know, men being angry with their wives for, you know, encouraging their girls to get married early. And also seeing the eyes of girls in the rural village glowing, seeing hope because of the performance that we're doing. And that's actually what, you know, ignited you know, the fire inside of me to do the work that I'm doing, because I believe that it has to take me to inspire many girls in my country to do to get good education and live better lives, and you know, avoid many abuses that girls go through, you know, in a male-dominated society. And that's what made me become one of the co-founders of Creative Center for Community Mobilization, a team of six that we were in the program, the GABO program. And really our mandate is to look at the disconnect between policy and practice, especially looking at the cultural institutions, the values and practices that really are inhibiting the effective implementation of our good policies. So Malawi has got very good policies around gender and education. But when you go to the ground, our statistics are telling us a totally different story. And that's where we are working. So my coming to Brookings was very inspirational for me, because I was looking at one of our policies, readmission. We're one of the first countries, one of the early countries in Africa to have the readmission policy in 1993. But then...
You mean readmission after girls get pregnant, they're allowed to come back to school?
Exactly. Yes, because before 1993, girls could not come back to school after getting pregnant. Yeah, so we had this policy in place, but on the ground, girls after getting pregnant were not going back to school. So I had time to reflect specifically to look at how cultural determinants are influencing the implementation, effective implementation of this readmission policy. And I think it was eye-opening to see that all were gender actors. So from minister down to the teacher in the classroom, to the girl herself, there were gender issues that were affecting implementation of the readmission policy. And really my agenda going back home was to make sure that we review this readmission policy so that it's effectively implemented, taking in mind the context that we're in. And so I'm happy to say that my agenda was achieved after a couple of years. For the first time, I think my coming in here brought in a lot of leverage and recognition by my government. The principal secretary for education was invited when I was in residence here. And really, that really, you know, brought recognition of the work that I was doing in the country. The director for secondary school, I remember the government sending her to come here to be with me in a couple of meetings while I was in DC. And going back, you know, I was like, let's look up to her. And for the first time, I was allowed to make a presentation in the Ministry of Education management meeting, which is hardly accessible for outsiders, like civil society organizations like me, even donors. I was able to do that and really influence the need to engage the traditional leaders and cultural institutions on issues of access, equity, as well as quality of education in our country. So we have reviewed our readmission policy, and I'm very happy to say that. That is taking consideration of all these issues that the context that our country is in. And right now I'm chairing the Malawi government has set up a National Girls Trust that really has a vision of taking leadership of girls' education issues in the country. It will turn up into a commission, a National Girls Commission, that will in-house all girl-related issues so that there should be leadership coordination around girls' issues in our country. So I'm chairing that that trust.
Great. Congrats. And this is just an aside, but Madalo and I have compared notes in the past where, you know, she was writing this report while she was here on, you know, what the Ministry of Education should do in Malawi. And lo and behold, the deputy minister, I think it was in D.C., and we found a way to get them together. And afterwards, she said, you know, she would have never met with me
if I hadn't been here at Brookings. And I said, I know how you feel because I came from an NGO, and Gene Sperling and others here at Brookings recruited me to take his place. And 2 weeks after I arrived, I got phone calls from people who I'd been trying to get a meeting with for like 2 years. And I was like, it's not me. I haven't done anything in 2 weeks at the Center for Universal Education. But something, and to me, that's a very telling anecdote that I think we have heard over and over from the Echidna Scholars and or other programs like it, which is exactly, Julia, what you were talking. If the global community can open up the space, what do we do with it? How can we use, and we think about it here with the Echidna Scholars program, our platform being globally connected to really amplify those voices, make those connections, make sure that the people who have the really good solutions on the ground are heard and supported and sustained. And I hope that other groups, those of you in this room and others outside this room who have those platforms, will do that for other people as well. Because I do think that is really the one way we're going to get to improving girls' education truly on the ground, not just in policy, excuse me, not just in words. Although you clearly need both. So last but not least, Damaris, so you have been, it's not even quite 12 months, almost in a couple weeks it'll be 12 months that you've been an alum. And you have been quite a force for girls' education in your community. You come from the Maasai community in Kenya, and there's, as I understand it, two counties, and you had an incredible father who supported you to go to school, and you're the first woman from that whole county who got a PhD. And at Egerton, you looked at religion and gender and taught and did academic work, but also you founded a center, and you were really like this deep support for young women who were going to university for the first time. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, why you wanted to come join us at the Echidna Scholars Fellowship and what you did while you're here, and in the last 12 months, what you've been incredibly busy. She's founded an NGO. She's got a fellowship at Harvard. She's writing a book. So, you know, no time's a-wasting. But give us a little bit of that story.
Thank you, Rebecca. I'm happy to be back here. So I come from the Maasai community from Kenya, and Maasai girls grapple with huge socio-cultural challenges to go to school. And as the first Maasai girl to earn a PhD from my community, I really deeply felt that I needed to work with girls' education. At the university, as we receive girls and boys and admit them to the university, I sit in University Senate and Dean's Committee, and we deliberate on that, and we look at the number of girls coming to university from marginalized areas, and I saw no Maasai girls, and that hurt me deeply, and I felt, as someone who's been given so much, I needed to be, that voice for Maasai girls. So when I came to this program, which was really sort of accidental, I was a visiting professor at the Urban Institute, and they brought us here to participate in a panel on girls' education. And at that moment, I had my me moment, mm-hmm. This is what I have wanted to do, and this is the space I have wanted to be in. And I quickly picked the brochures on my long haul back home. I had written my proposal for the Echidna Global Scholarship, and I was thankfully admitted. I came here, and I had the space to write and to rethink the socio-cultural issues that Maasai girls face, and who are the actors, who are the people, who are the gatekeepers to work with, because Maasai children are so heavily socialized into a deep web of cultural issues, including female genital mutilation, early marriage, that so heavily impacts them that the few that go to school drop out of the way after they undergo the cultural rituals. So I spent time writing about female genital mutilation and the deep role that culture plays in that. And so that space, you know, it gave me the voice and the platform to highlight these issues, to speak about these issues, and, you know, to disseminate evidence-based research on a global level and on a local level. And that is having impact back home. Our national examinations are going on right now in Kenya. And the highlight of that was that so many girls were getting pregnant and giving birth on the day of the examinations. And before I came here, the governor of my county called me and said, you are writing on girls' education. You have to help us find a solution for why girls are getting pregnant, for the few that go to school. Thank you.
That's great. And tell us a little bit about your new NGO that you're founding, Let Maasai Girls Learn.
Yeah, so Let Maasai Girls Learn. I founded Let Maasai Girls Learn when I came here. It's my personal initiative, my personal contribution to mobilize the world, global leaders, local leaders, spiritual leaders, community leadership to help us take Maasai girls to school. And so that organization is running, the website is going to run in the next 1 month. And what I am doing is engaging community leaders. You know, when I was doing my research here, I know for sure Kenya has a beautiful constitution. It has a great Bill of Rights. We have lofty policies, good policies that should take every girl to school, Maasai girls, any girl in Kenya to school. But you find that despite that, Maasai girls are still not going to school. Maasai girls are still subjected to female genital mutilation, still at 89%. And we've had so many programs focusing on eradicating that. So I realize there's a deep problem there, and we need to know and delineate what is the source of this problem, who are causing these problems. Then I realize that it's the community leadership, whether you're talking about Maasai cultural leadership or the spiritual leaders in Maasai land, and I mean non-denominational spiritual leaders and spiritual leaders to denominational leaders, I realize that we can't have any impact unless we work with the local leaders. So Let Maasai Girls Learn, which is heavily inspired by Michelle Obama. And I remember watching the documentary, Let Girls Learn, in my sitting room at home, watching CNN, and I watched this program, and, you know, I just broke down. I started crying and thinking, you know, this is what I need to do. I mean, it was so clear to me in my mind and in my soul, in my spirit, that this is what I want to do. So I have been setting this NGO to be able to mobilize everybody that can support me to take Maasai girls to school.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. You brought up again, and Christina talked about it, Michelle Obama's Global Girls Alliance, which we were very happy to help design and do the research for and incubate. And Mayada, I think you were the MENA leader in the design phase. And it was clear that there was, because to be honest, when the Obama administration asked us to help them with this, we said, well, we're not sure that girls' education leaders are going to use a network like this. What is it that they really want? We have to go out and ask girls' ed leaders themselves, and that was sort of our role. Several things came out. One is that it's very lonely in many times being in communities where you are bucking the trend and trying to do mindset change. It can be dangerous. There's riots, and Khadam, you didn't talk about it, but he certainly shared with us some, you know, threats, personal threats, security threats when he went home. And I'm sure everybody who works in the space is familiar and aware of that.
And so there was this idea of we want to be connected to each other as moral support. But there was also an idea that we want to share technical resources. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. If you have a great set of materials on child marriage, we'd like to borrow. And then the third piece was we want help and beefing up our expertise really around organizational management. How do you do a good budget? How do you do a good comms plan? What's some staffing and management tips? And so that's really what the Global Girls Alliance has been focused on. And since that time, we have been doing here, it's for the last 2 years, leadership training with the Echidna Scholar alumni. And this is something that's come, like many of our girls' education policy work here at the center, from the Echidna scholars themselves, saying, you know, we'd like to get together, and it's not necessarily just the things that the Global Girls Alliance are now starting to do, but it's also really around, you know, leadership skills. Some might call them soft skills, but educationalists in the room hate the term soft skills. Can you guys just really briefly down the line tell us a little bit about, you know, what do you find are some of the most important sets of competencies and skills for you continuing to be an effective leader in this space? Just really briefly, I'll start with you.
I think my time here granted me so much skills. Leadership skills. The leadership program that, you know, the year-long leadership program that we underwent was so incredibly helpful to me, helping me to understand myself, gaining emotional intelligence, being able to recognize my weaknesses and my strength, because I seriously believe that for me to be an effective leader, I need to know myself better. And so that was really helpful for me, that I know myself better. I know how to catch myself in my moments of weakness. But that also helped me to understand the people that I work with very deeply, and how to approach that and how to do better interventions. More importantly, the skills, the writing skills, the communication skills, writing evidence-based policy briefs and blogs was so helpful to me that actually when I got back home, I have my other life as an academic. It was difficult for me to write as an academic now. So that was incredible. It continues to impact on how I communicate with local leaders, political leaders, religious leaders. And so it was really greatly impactful. It continues to impact my life to date, and I'm very grateful for that.
Apart from what you said, another thing that really helped me and continues to help me is the peer consultancy that is happening around among us. Going back, I was promoted to become the leader of the organization. When I was coming here, I was the director of programs. So really, I needed skills on how I would manage.
And you're now, Madala, the executive director.
Yes, okay. I am. So I need a lot of skills on how I can manage this large organization in my country, and especially around financial sustainability. I think our discussions with colleagues on how we can become financially sustainable were very key. And I think at a point I was coming to the organization to lead it, we had some financial challenges. Most of our projects were ending, and we had not had the successful grants on board. And as local CSOs, very limited, or nothing, no unrestricted funding. No growth, really. No funding to strengthen our systems so that we can be scale ready as CSOs. And this is what we are grappling with as local CSOs. And I think being here and sharing our challenges, I'm so grateful that it made our team to start to think differently on how we should become financially sustainable as a local CSO, because over 90% of our funding is restricted funding to projects. And really meaning that we cannot exist without a donor. And we really thought, this is a little stupid because we can't survive on somebody else's pocket all the way. We need to have something, core funding, that can make us be sustained even in the drought of funding. So that's what really kept me thinking around how best we can grow financially and be sustainable. And I was very successful to solicit, you know, mobilize resources. And I thank God for foundations that were very understanding with this vision. And in the 2 years, I think for the first time in the life of my organization, we're able to get over $330,000 for institutional strengthening only.
Hard to do. Excellent. Mayada.
Yes. For me, I mean, when I came here, I get passionate about causes. And when I get passionate, I begin to run. And when I run really fast. And the problem is sometimes I find myself alone. And there is nobody around me. So what I really learned here is the power of networking, really. The power of having cheerleaders. The power of holding each other's hand and walking together. And I think that was so evident in the residency. It was only 4 months, but really the support we got. I have to also tell you, the last month of the residency, we go around and meet many people in D.C. We make friends like the FHI 360, Sherry. You know, we've worked together for the past like 2-3 years after the residency. We make, you know, so it just gives you this support system that is much needed instead of running alone and finding yourself alone in the desert. And when I went back as well, we created also, inspired by what's happening here, we created something called a movement called Women as Partners in Progress. We started 30 women, now we're 50 women. We're going to bring men on board as well, and we're working, and they're leaders, we're emerging leaders and leaders that are together working to do change basically on the policy level. It is a funded project from the University of Maryland, another friend I met here as well. And you know, this powerful network on the ground, on the Paris policy level, and then this, the network of the Girls Alliance across the region, MENA region, I think this is just a powerful, you know, this is what I really got out of it. So, thank you.
So, your question is about the residency here, or about the...
Just what are sort of the skills or other things, Madala talked about financing, that you need to continue to be an effective leader?
So in terms of my organization, financial sustainability, we already been working, but very limited. But after my return and having this some skills and knowledge learned from here, we expanded our outreach. We started working in Islamabad as well. We are a partner of Global Fund for Children. They support us. And in Islamabad, I would like to invite you all, when you come to Islamabad, there is a community just after 2-minute drive from President's and Prime Minister of Pakistan and the diplomatic enclave where all embassies exist. So we call that Barimam, if many of you visited there may know. The community there, they live in 13th century conditions. So when I've initially believed that my region I belong to, Gilgit-Baltistan, that is mountainous, remote, and there would be no other part in the country or in the world that is backward like us. But when I went to Barimam, there was really more backward than my own village. So Ma'am Jamila might know about that. So we have started working there. And also we started English Works program. That is a 6-month program focused on youth, 17 to 25 years. That is a gender equal literacy program. We provide not only English language, that is a tool to use, but we teach 21st century skills, life skills, social skills. So as a result, just after graduation recently, 10%, we had 100 students, 10%, 10 students got jobs. So inspired of the skills and my learning that work in the field and expanded my organization.
Great. Thanks, Kadam. And we'll circle back to you on sort of other big challenges. I know also you're, I think, becoming a partner with Go Rising, right?
Yes.
Which is great. Another wonderful girls' education organization. So
I'm just checking with Christina and Lucy because my watch has stopped and I think the clock is wrong up there. I think we go to Q&A for the next half hour. Am I right? Okay, excellent. So we have plenty of time for discussion and questions, and raise your hands high, and a microphone will come around. And then I also have just a couple last questions we'll do to close. So any questions for our panelists or comments from the floor? I think, Kim, are you raising your hand?
I am raising
okay,
my
go
hand.
For it.
Madalo, my question's personal. So what were your parents' reaction watching the trajectory of your career?
They're amazed. This time when I was coming in, my mama told me, I wish I could come along with you and see the USA. But she's a very happy woman now to see what has happened, not just to me, but to my younger siblings, because I was able to draw them into getting good education, and now they're in good jobs because of, you know, the step I took as a person. But also to say that my whole clan is inspired to see me and what, you know, is happening with me. Just a couple of days ago, I was on NBC Today's show. And my country was talking. Our radio stations were talking about me. I mean, it's quite inspirational to see how a rural girl who was, you know, hopeless at some point can get so transformed and change her own world. Yeah.
Do you want to tell them what it was like to be on the Today Show with Michelle Obama?
I was over the moon to talk to be talking with Jenna Bush. Actually, I didn't know that she was the daughter of George Bush. she's down to earth and a very lively person to be with, and it was quite inspiring. For them to come over, you know, it's something that we can't access as a local CSO. We don't have the, you know, the funding to be able to appear in that program. But I think because of the connections here, this really has inspired not just me, not even just the girls that were empowering, but also many girls in Malawi. Yeah.
Other questions? Yes, here on the aisle. Raise your hand high so they can see.
First, thank you for a great panel. Very inspiring. My name is Sherry Youssef, and I work at FHI 360. I feel like the morning started a little more with a top-down angle, and now with this panel, it's much more of a bottom-up, grassroots, organic kind of move for change. I know there's an endless debate, regardless of the topic in development, whether it is top-down or bottom-up. And I guess as you four step back, what is your advice for future change makers, for the younger generation? Is it better to do what you've done kind of and come at it organically from the grassroots, or to start top down and really see that's where scale of change can take place? I'm wondering what your perspective is having gone down that route.
Who wants to tackle that? Go ahead, Mary.
Yes. I think we can work on both ends. I think we can work on bottom up end, and I think that's most effective. And I think also policy is a place where also we need to be working. So I think both meet together to create the strongest system. I just wanted to say also, by working and identifying local leaders, we will not fall into the same problem we fell in my earlier experience, where you do work, you keep on doing work, and then you don't see the result that you want to see. So you continue doing the same thing over and over and over again. If there are any donors here, if there are any people working in development, if we do not really identify grassroots people, we don't identify local context, it's going to be very, very difficult to do change. And 10 years of the same thing, you know, the women employment participation in the workforce remains between 15 and 17% till now. It's been 10 years. We've done everything in Jordan to help that. And if we really don't address the real issues by finding local leaders, I think it's a problem. And finally, I've I'm working on this, my PhD now, and it is it's about integral development. And integral development means that we really go into our inner call and see how we can change communities starting from bottom up and connecting to it. So I think these kind of programs, in addition to what we've had here, actually does the real change.
We harness an internship program. That's where I came from, because we believe that it exposes future leaders of Malawi to be proper policy implementers when they go through the grassroots work. I think to us, this is very, very crucial for leadership in girls' education, in the issues that we are doing. I don't think I would become what I am today with the passion that I have if I hadn't gone through that internship program. Sitting down with one of our funders one day, they had changed their strategy because they said they wanted to do national advocacy. And we were all shocked to say, you can't do national advocacy if you don't have the issues on the ground. And many years later, I was laughing at them. I said, do you know that this change that happened, the school improvement planning and granting in Malawi, was the influence of your project that you changed strategy many years ago? So they were shocked because they thought that by moving from implementation to national advocacy, they will make greater impact in the nation. And yet, the project that we're implementing on the ground, we're able to influence national players because of the evidence that was coming out from the ground. Yeah.
I think girls' education leadership is a partnership, and it's layers upon layers of networking and partnering with various players. Global players are so important, but so are local grassroots actors. Grassroots actors are the people on the ground. They have the trust of communities. They know the challenges. They bring unique perspective into the partnership, but they cannot do that alone. So we need each other. Global leaders need local leaders. Local leaders need global leaders. And I think when we have that kind of a web working together, we are more effective, because the challenges on the ground are just so bad sometimes that it damages you. And so you need support from everywhere to be able to do that. But sometimes also we run risk of many things. Global leaders sometimes are working with the wrong leaders on the ground. And global leaders have a tendency to create celebrities out of local leaders and give them the space and amplify their voices and become big people. And that kind of goes into their heads. But when you ask people on the ground whether these people are really doing the real things, they are having a very minimum impact on the ground. So it's a balance. And I would add global leaders to be able to, to be on top of things to make sure that even as they work with local actors, they know those local actors really very well.
Yes, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. Can you raise your hands? Hi, we're going to go, let's start from the back. There's two in the back, and then we'll do 1, 2, 3.
Thank you very much. It was interesting to hear the two ladies from Kenya and Malawi.
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. My name is Tolu Omodara. I'm a Nigerian, but I'm doing my grad studies here in the U.S. It was interesting to hear the two ladies talk about implementation capacity. I'm paraphrasing. I heard both of them say, oh, we have beautiful policies and this and that, but the problem is implementation. And I can identify with that as a Nigerian. I want to speak a little bit on the government side. What can we do to strengthen implementation capacity? Because as much as we can do our best as civil society organizations, the government still has what I like to call the grandfather effect. If we don't strengthen implementation capacity, we'll do our best, but we may still be chipping at the fringes. How can we build that institutional strength, especially for policy implementation?
So that's we have to remember. I've dropped my pen. My watch doesn't work. I've dropped my pen. I'm very unprepared. Okay, so implementation capacity, because I think we should take a couple of questions, you guys, and then you pick which one you want to answer in interest of time. So thank you for that question. There's another question at the back. And please do introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Morgan Krett. I work with the Global Partnership for Education. And my question is really about what are some of the ways to all the panelists, what are some of the best ways and strategies for engaging men and boys? What have you found that has been most effective? And what have you come across as difficulties? And how does that help change the mindset towards girls' education?
Great, great question. We have... Yes, here on the side.
Hi, my name is Barbara Gagliardi. I'm with ABSI USA. We've heard your incredible journeys. And my question is, you know, now that, I don't know, it seems a number of years since you've started, are the headwinds stronger now? Do you feel that there is a moment that things are moving in your local context where you can sort of galvanize things, or are we still facing the same sticking points?
That's a great question. Yes, we have two questions here, and we'll stop after that round, and I know we'll try to squeeze in a second round if we have time.
Hi, my name is Zach Fowler with Wiser International in Kenya. This is a question for the whole panel. In our experience, we work in an area where only 3% of girls attend college, but 90% of our program graduates go on to college, and they come back to us and they say, wow, you know, my local community thinks of me as a hero, they look at me as a role model, but I have more pressure than I've ever had, and they expect new things of me. And I'm curious to know if you all, as local leaders who have emerged from areas with little precedent of success, if you're facing new types of pressures and nudges from the people that that you grew up with.
Interesting. And Urvashi, last one here. Yep, here.
I'm Urvashi Sani, a former Echidna alumni, and I work and live in India for girls' education. Thank you for the lovely panel, and thank you, Echidna, for the great opportunity for me too. My question really is to you, Rebecca, and to others in the Global North. You know, and thank you, Echidna, for recognizing that you need voices from the Global South in the to participate in the global conversation, and for having given us so much of a voice and to the opportunity to share in some of these platforms. So my question really is to you, Rebecca, and to others from the Global North, that we've heard a lot about how it has enriched local leaders in girls' education from the Global South, but I think I would really like to hear from the Global North and from Brookings that how have these voices shaped the global conversation going forward? I'm sure they have, and I think we don't hear enough about that, and that would be good to hear. Thank you.
Great. So why don't you each pick one question to answer, and I will take the last question about how, you know, what's the influence on the global conversation, having local leaders be part of the debates. So there's a question on implementation capacity, a question on men and boys, a really interesting question, I thought, on do you feel headwinds are stronger? Do you feel the moment that we're talking about at the global level down in your communities where you're making change, or and many of you are working actually at national level, so at your countries? And the question about expectations, which also is interesting. Do you feel there's greater expectations and pressure on you? Who would like to take what? Hadam, you want to start? Pick your favorite?
The expectations.
Expectations? Okay.
So you know, being a grassroots leader that is in the context I come from, have much more pressure because we have different political and religious circumstances there in my country. So for a grassroots leader, there are two options. One, you gain the media and become very popular and do something you want, you achieve your objective through use of media, the approach. But that needs very strong political and military background. You cannot survive or continue the media reputation. The other option is you work at grassroots level very calmly, and then let's speak the change. And I use that because I personally faced many blames for being a Western agent, a U.S. agent. And people think that the change is something very threatening to their belief, their traditions, their culture. So I work very calmly and engaging the youth and facing the challenges as at the bottom level. And responding to the previous questions, the bottom up, I think that if there is innovation, if there is a scale up, the bottom up, top bottom approach is working. But for addressing basic issues that faced by a community, the grassroots and bottom up approach always work, and that is sustained and accepted by the community.
Great, thanks. Who would like to go next?
Yeah, I think
Mayada. Which question do you want to take?
So I'm going to talk about do you make a change? Do you think you can make a change, or like
the headwinds question?
The headwinds, yeah.
So if, is that it, or is it some other question?
I don't know about the headwinds, but yes, that's the question. So if 2 years ago I was sitting here, it would have been a lot different than now. Like, I finished 4 years ago, right? But the first 2 years were such rough times to work in, because you come in from Brookings, you have this new thought, you have this new idea, and you want to bring people on board. Like, there were points where I was in despair. This is not going to work, you know? Nobody's listening to me. I can't get people on board. And now, four years later, there is a whole studies about mindset changes. The World Bank just came up with a study saying that mindset change is among the biggest problems. The Pro-Mundo study. So everybody comes to me, oh, you were right. But 2 years ago, nobody was even listening to me. So I think there is this resistance. Like, one of the things as well, I'm going to be fast about this. There's a policy in the Ministry of the Ministry of Labor. It's an Article 69 that says that there are certain jobs that women should not be doing, or forbidden to make women do. And among them is a geologist. Imagine. Among the geologists, that's why 25 years ago, I was told by all these males to leave because of the job for me. So now with this group, the Women as Partners of Progress, we're working on Article 69, and we're working on abolishing it, and we've become strong enough to actually do this change. So like 5 years ago, before this, 4 years ago, I wouldn't have done it. Yes, so there is this movement, and there is a change. So yeah,
great. Madalo, you and Damaris can draw straws on the last question you want to.
Yes, I'll do the, how do we institutionalize effective implementation of policies? To me, what we have seen to be key in my country is the government ownership of implementation of these policies. I think we do have a tendency to run with a thing and leave government behind, officers behind. I think this is one of the killer issues that we are facing in development. The social issues we are handling are quite complex, and really they require congruently complex approaches in order for us to make a huge difference, because to me, girls' education is a social issue in my country that is quite complex, because it's dealing with our gender norms and social norms. So it's a cultural thing. And we really have to, all of us, take ownership of this, starting with government, but also the cultural institutions. These are very key in my country. And you can't, you know, just quicken them. They must take their time, and you must flow their natural flow. The challenge we're having as local CSOs is that donors push us, because they have timelines and deliverables. So I think this is what we are grappling with, to be honest with you, as a grassroots leader. This is my greatest irony that we are grappling with. And I'm happy to say that there are some foundations like Echidna that is trying to give us a leeway on how we can make sure that the local people naturally take ownership of this process. And I think it's working very, very powerfully in my country. Because we don't want a tendency where we implement projects for 3 years. You know, they show very good results. Go back after 1 year, you'll be shocked. You'll be shocked. And this is what is disheartening to us as local people, to say there's so much invested in donor aid in this country. But after the implementation phase, that's the end of it. But that's not what we want, and I'm sure that's not what donors even want. They would want to see that the money that they're investing is making impact, not just in the short term, but in the long term.
Thank you.
What about men and boys? I hope that was the question you wanted to answer.
No, I didn't get that.
You feel free to answer a different one, but if you have thoughts on men and boys.
I actually didn't get that question very well. If I got it better, then I would answer that. But I would take Zach's question.
Yeah, on the expectations.
And the policy. So for me, I have grappled with expectations for as long as I can remember. And but it became worse when I went back home. And every Maasai person feels like I can give a scholarship to their daughter, or they simply send them to my house and, you know, leave them there and say, fix them in school and do what you want to do with them. And that has really led to a lot of, you know, strains on my part. I can't keep up with the calls from Maasai parents asking me what to do and how best I can help them. The best one is that I can help admit them to the university if they have passed. If they haven't passed their examinations, then I have a problem. So that expectation is there, and I'm learning to manage that. The question on policy implementation is it's kind of hard when you have beautiful policies that are supposed to ensure that there is equity, there is access to education for all, and then that doesn't happen. But it's interesting to me that issues pop up that force policymakers into action. Like the issue I spoke about earlier on girls getting pregnant and giving birth when they are doing examinations. This has been a big thing. If you just Google that in Kenya, it's a big thing right now. And for as long as I remember, feminists have been talking about the need for, you know, to have comprehensive sex education in schools. Spiritual leaders have fought that like crazy. And this week, the Minister for Education, thankfully she's a woman, is beginning to rethink what are the things that we need to focus on. Yes, we have policies, but things are happening that are scaring everybody. So sometimes issues have a way of forcing policymakers to act, and we pray that more of those issues. Okay, I don't pray that girls get pregnant, but I pray that sometimes issues crop up that allow policymakers to rethink their position and to rethink interventions and to look for people who have, you know, solutions to offer. I think that's what I can say.
Thank you. And I would just add to what you said, Damaris, is for me, that example of having an issue crop up to the national agenda, making perhaps a big significant change more likely, is why we need to invest very strongly in agile local leaders, because then you need the people on the ground who are well-skilled, well-equipped to maneuver, to quickly take that and do what Julia talked about at the global level. If you're given a policy space, if you're given a moment, you need people to come in and take it and make something of it, which is what you are all doing in your own ways. So I will close with Urvashi's question, because it is actually a thank you. I didn't plant that with you, but thank you, because it's a perfect closing. All of you, not only the four of you here on the stage and the four of four wonderful echidna,
I'm looking for all of them. There they are. Our current Echidna cohort, when you'll get a chance to hear from them shortly, but all of the Echidna scholars in the audience, it have been incredibly influential in our work here at the Center for Universal Education. And we, for a long time, we do two things. We work globally in our girls' education work, thinking about the global agenda on girls' education. And then, of course, with the Echidna Scholars Program, it's really about helping in a different type of impact strategy, support and foster and accelerate local country-based solutions that each Echidna scholar comes up with. And what we found, that was sort of our theory on our PowerPoint, you know, when we talked about what we do. We had the global level, and then we have this country-based local level. And what we didn't have in our theory of change when we started was how much there's a link between the two. And what we found was that the input from the Echidna scholars greatly shaped our global work. It shaped, for example, we did a piece of work on with a lot of you in this room, various consultations in the girls' education community. You know, what are sort of the next big agenda for girls' education? What are the, you know, big topics that we want all these newfound advocates? It was a, you know, we had Malala enter the stage, which almost I feel like changed everything in terms of global awareness. And we had people coming out increasingly at the global level to advocate for girls' education. How did we want to harness their energies and focus? And we had the predictable ones. You know, we had early childhood through secondary, so access. We had improved quality. We had school to work. We had gender perspective, mainstreaming. And I don't know if you even remember this, Judith Ann. We had a consultation with Julia Gillard, who is, as you all know, a wonderful advocate for our sector and also sits with us at Brookings as a distinguished fellow. And she does a lot of work with us. And we were talking about this next what should be the next global agenda for girls' education. And Judith, you said, yeah, this is a great list. We had done a number of consultations with girls' education actors. And you said, you know, but what you need is also to have a global commitment to empower local leaders. And that came out very strongly in the rest of our consultations. And it ended up going into our work and being a piece of our What Works in Girls Education volume. It was picked up by the Obama administration and was the focus of their Let Girls Learn initiative. And so really it's been incredibly influential for us to have the honor of hosting all of you. Everyone is always thankful when you leave about the opportunity, but really it's our honor and our luck. And we are grateful. And I would say we at the center are very grateful, but I would also imagine that everyone in this room also is grateful to get a chance to spend time with you and talk to you and get to know you. And you do make sacrifices to leave your families and your work for several months. So thank you very much from the bottom of our hearts. And please give them a round of applause.